From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Air America has been reincarnated so often, it ought to be pretty far along the path to enlightenment. Yet it seems to be on the verge of yet another rebirth. Before we consider its next life, let's quickly review the past ones. It started back in 2003 when investor Sheldon Drobny and his wife Anita decided to launch a liberal talk radio network. Before the year was out, they'd sold their new company to Evan Cohen and Mark Walsh. Finally, on March 31st, 2004, Air America launched. Al Franken was at the helm.
Today is both an ending and a beginning. An end to the right-wing dominance of talk radio, the beginning of a battle for truth, a battle for justice, a battle indeed for America itself, not to be grandiose.
Mark Walsh was the CEO of Progress Media, Air America's parent company. In 2004, we asked him if Air America would lose its raison d'etre if John Kerry won the presidential election.
If John Kerry wins in 2004, I think our business is even better. Why? Because Tom DeLay ain't going away. Nino Scalia ain't going away. Dennis Hastert and Trent Lott and Bill Frist are not going away.
Actually, everyone he listed but Anthony Scalia has more or less gone away. But so did Mark Walsh 4 weeks after Air America's debut. So did Air America's VP for programming. And after that, Chairman Evan Cohen left, along with Vice Chairman Rex Sorensen. In October 2004, we got an update from The Washington Post's Paula Spann.
Things looked grim. For a couple of weeks, people didn't know if they were going to be on the air the next day or not. They got some new investors. They reorganized. Things have stabilized. And part of what kept them going, I think, virtually none of the staff left, even though they were afraid of not getting paid. No one could stand to think about what Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity would say if the much ballyhooed liberal radio network went kaput after a month.
In March 2005, we spoke with filmmaker Patrick Farrelly, who had spent time behind the scenes at Air America making the HBO documentary Left of the Dial. He said CEO Evan Cohen had everyone believing there was plenty of money to ride out the bad times. There wasn't.
I think at that point, Evan Cohen was in denial. I mean, ultimately, the guy is a salesman. He's never going to say that, in fact, you know, that he sold people a bill of goods. Among the staff, there was this intense sense of betrayal. And he basically, you know, he just disappeared off the scene.
On the scene was new CEO Danny Goldberg, a music industry veteran and founder of Artemis Records. We spoke to him, too.
I've got either the foolishness or the guts to try to do it, and yeah, I don't think there's any one person that would have all the different tools. Hopefully I've got enough of them not to screw it up.
Well, a year later, April 2006, he packed up his toolkit and left. 2 months later, network president Gary Krantz left. In October 2006, Air America filed for bankruptcy. Rob Glaser stepped in with some cash to keep them on the air while they figured things out. And that brings us to this week, when yet two more owners have stepped into the picture. Brian Maloney writes the blog Radio Equalizer, and he joins me now to review the latest developments. Brian, welcome to On the Media.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Stephen and Mark Green, who are they, and what are they fixing to do?
Stephen Green is a very, very wealthy developer, extremely well-known in Manhattan and on Wall Street, with a brother who is known in New York for his political background, run for office a number of times, and is a political activist. But I think Stephen Green certainly shares his political views.
For a reported $4.25 million, they are acquiring the goose that lays the leaden egg. What could they possibly be thinking?
Well, it's hard to understand beyond perhaps that this has really been about political advocacy more than making money from day one. Air America has essentially, its parent companies have been part of an ongoing shell game where people step in, they give their money, they never see a dime that a new company is created, and the assets are transferred to that new company, and then nobody sees their money again. And that's exactly what has happened this time. So I would hope that anyone investing money in this company at this point would not expect to see their money back, because I don't think the track record's very good.
Now, Brian, this has been reported to be a $4.25 million deal. But based on what you've blogged, I get the idea that actually the Greens have paid only $1 million for back rent and legal fees and so forth. And for that, they've actually acquired, by way of assets, nothing?
That's right. Really, most of this money is a loan that's been forgiven that Rob Glaser made in October to keep the network afloat while they were in bankruptcy court. He's forgiving that loan in exchange for a stake in the new company. So there's no real money changing hands. That's an accounting maneuver. The rest of it is going to pay lawyers, accountants, the landlord, a labor union, and others that are owed money currently. No assets are actually being purchased with this money. And that is what is not being reported in the press, because really nobody took the time to look at the filings and to see what was in them. And that is how we get to this strange new chapter in Air America's long and twisted history. The only real hope here is that Stephen Green will actually come forward and contribute some money in the future. And I think that's the real reason why he's the new owner of the network.
Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Maloney writes the blog Radio Equalizer. In more struggling radio news, this week, in a long-anticipated move, the nation's only two satellite radio providers announced plans to merge. Sirius and XM Radio, having racked up a cumulative $7 billion loss over their 7 years of existence, have determined that only together can they ever turn a profit. But agreeing to merger terms is hardly the end of the story. The deal has to be approved by both the Justice Department's Antitrust Division and the Federal Communications Commission, whose license of both companies explicitly forbids their merger. Blair Levin was FCC Chief of Staff when those licenses were issued, and now is an analyst for the Stifel Financial Corporation. He joins me now. Blair, welcome to Terrestrial Radio.
Oh, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
The rule that prohibits Sirius and XM from merging was written back in 1997. Is it a part of legislation? Is it a regulatory provision? What?
It's actually a paragraph in the FCC grant of a license to Sirius and XM, which means that it is essentially an FCC rule. And like all FCC rules, it is subject to a future FCC saying we don't need that rule anymore. So it can be overturned by the votes of three commissioners.
Going back a decade, what was in the commission's minds when it inserted that paragraph into the licensing process?
I was actually at the commission at the time. I was chief of staff. And the way I recall us thinking about it was that nobody knew for certain how this service of satellite radio would develop. The basic thought was that we wanted to send them a message that we wanted them to compete with each other. But it was a very different time then, and certainly there are a lot of changes in the marketplace that the companies are going to claim means that that rule is no longer needed.
And as you say, in the marketplace, the only thing that has changed in the intervening time is everything. We're now living in the internet age and the iPod age. And I gather you believe that the competition from non-satellite radio sources of programming content make the original agreement obsolete. Tell me why.
The question that is kind of on the table today is, will the Department of Justice and the FCC allow this proposed merger to go through? At the end of the day, my view is, even though it's a close call, I think the Department of Justice is more likely than not to approve the deal, largely because of all the different changes in the marketplace.
What about the rest of the content environment would keep a satellite radio monopoly from behaving in a monopolistic way?
The companies will claim that the presence of things like iPods, internet radio, digital radio, which is coming online now, as well as a number of services from wireless companies like Verizon and AT&T, basically put them in a position where if they raise rates, they will lose more customers and they will gain revenue.
It would seem that the Department of Justice, even under a business-friendly Bush administration, signaled its tendencies a couple of years ago when it killed a proposed merger between DirecTV and EchoStar, two satellite TV networks. Can we draw any conclusions from the fact that they wouldn't buy that merger?
I think a lot of antitrust folks think that the current head of the antitrust division is more open to allowing certain kind of mergers that the previous person was not so open to. But more importantly, that really involved the video market. And the video market is very different than the audio market. The kinds of things that we were talking about that the company certainly believed do provide competition today, things like the iPod, things like Verizon's music service. There was no analogy to that in the video context. The DBS deal, which they turned down, had a pretty simple product market, which was multi-channel video distribution. And there basically were just cable companies and satellite companies doing it. In this case, if you think the product market is really satellite radio, then it's pretty clear that you turn the deal down. But if you think the product market is broader to something like mobile audio services, well, then you have to look at all these other elements and see how much competition there is. Secondly, in the DBS merger, there was a particular problem in rural America where really there were only two providers of the multi-channel video service. You don't have that kind of rural problem here.
We on this program and many, many others have been focused for the last 5 or 6 years under the Bush administration, FCC, on the question of media concentration. Is it possible that the technology that is changing the definition of what satellite radio is has also changed the definition of what media concentration is and renders a lot of the debate on the subject more or less moot?
There are certainly a lot of people, including Chairman Michael Powell, who was the prior chairman of the FCC, who I think took the view that, well, the internet changes everything and therefore we just really don't need that many rules anymore. In some ways, like in the case of satellite radio, it may be that digital media means they can merge, but that doesn't mean that the way people get local news has changed so much that you want to change the newspaper broadcast ownership rule or some other local news rule. You actually have to look at not just the question of market share, but how people get their news. So it's certainly related, but I don't think the answer in this particular case necessarily answers the question in every case.
Well, Blair, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Blair Levin is a telecommunications and media analyst at the Stifel Financial Corporation.
Coming up, what evangelical really means and the media manipulations of a very bad Belgian.
This is On the Media from NPR.
If you can hear me right now, then you're listening to the podcast, and we were one of the first national radio shows to offer a podcast. The thing is, it's free for you, but it costs us money. So would you consider sending our station, WNYC, a little extra to help pay for it? Just go to WNYC.org and let them know that our podcast matters to you. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's been kind of a tough year for evangelicals. As a voting bloc critical to the GOP's supposed permanent majority in Congress, they failed to stave off midterm election disaster. Meanwhile, two documentaries, Friends of God, A Road Trip with Alexandra Pelosi, and Jesus Camp, portrayed them in extremis.
How many of you want to be those who would give up their lives for Jesus?
We're being trained to be God's army.
Not enough!
Some in born-again Christian circles think the problem is the very term evangelical, which has become stigmatized by the bigoted stereotype and the excesses of a relative few. But Tim Morgan of Christianity Today says, not so fast. Instead of swapping terminology, isn't it better to understand and influence the conversation?
We're defined in the media by what we are against. We are associated in the public's mind with extreme fundamentalism. And we're linked by evangelicalism's critics with the secular political agenda of the hard right.
I guess the quintessential stereotyping abuse happened in 1993 when the Washington Post, in an explainer piece about the political movement, described evangelicals as, quote, largely poor, uneducated, and easy to command. Do you remember it?
Yes, I surely do. I had recently joined the staff at Christianity Today, and we saw this huge reaction among conservative Christians. They were calling the Post. They were sending in their tax returns. They were doing any number of things to prove to the Washington Post and to the Washington media that they're actually wealthy in some cases. They're well-educated, and they have a pretty good cross-section of political views.
Do you think that the media have gotten more nuanced in their invoking of the word evangelical since the 1993 Washington Post atrocity?
You can certainly say that the media has given greater focus to evangelicals. You find that evangelicals will appear on the front page of the New York Times. You will see that evangelical commentary will be on the op-ed pages. So in that respect, the evangelical voice is more clearly heard. It's a real challenge even for evangelicals inside our movement to understand where we really inhabit the public policy debate, in part because there isn't an evangelical pope. There's not a house of bishops for evangelicals that can sit down and debate these things and settle them once and for all. So you find that certain prominent leaders raise themselves up.
As you point out, various religious leaders over time have put themselves forward as very, very prominent spokesmen for large constituencies. I'm talking about Pat Robertson. I'm talking about Jerry Falwell, Ted Haggard. Each of these guys having had one or more vastly embarrassing public moments. What does it do to the movement, and what does it do to stigmatize the word evangelical itself?
It definitely has harmful impacts. There's no question that the most recent scandal involving Ted Haggard damaged the public perception of evangelicalism. Evangelicalism has always had a controversial history. If you go back to the early days of evangelicalism, when it was trying to distinguish itself from, you know, modern liberalist Christianity and also fundamentalism, even from the early days of Billy Graham, when he would have crusades where blacks and whites would intermingle. That was an example of social justice that was controversial in Southern crusades. At the same time, there are examples of excesses, whether it is the street evangelist, whether it's the televangelist scandals of the 1980s. There have been cases where people have abused money, sex, and power, and it's caused hurt to the cause of Christ. And so evangelicalism has become a movement that I describe as embattled but thriving.
In Christianity Today, you wrote an editorial called Save the E-Word, in favor of not ditching the term evangelical, but embracing it. As a pure public relations matter, tell me why it's a mistake not to just find another word that is less charged and move on from there.
I think evangelicalism is a word that is worth saving and a word that's worth fighting for. It's a biblical word. It's a word that carries the power of the gospel message, the good news that we experience through Jesus Christ. This issue of stigmatizing the movement needs to be addressed head on, and we need to, as evangelicals, ask ourselves, why does the public not perceive us in a more positive light? To what extent is that our own fault? To what extent can we be in a more honest relationship with people who disagree with us so that they also sense that we respect them as people? So we have actually hard questions to answer within the evangelical movement. I think that's the point I'm trying to get at.
Well, Tim, I very much appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure being on the air with you.
Tim Morgan is Deputy Managing Editor for Christianity Today. We got a heap of email from you concerning Brooks' discussion last week with J.J. Goldberg, editor of The Forward, about whether certain Jewish groups were squelching debate about Israel. Here are two that represent the range. First, Chip Pringle had this to say, quote, "I was really glad that you tackled the issue of Zionist bias in the U.S. media. That's the elephant in the room that nobody talks about. But your segment left me intensely disappointed. What a shame to address this topic by bringing in an apologist for Zionist media. Mr. Goldberg deserves to have his say, but if the issue is that media consistently depict the Arab-Israeli conflict through a Zionist lens, what we need to hear certainly is not more analysis from a Zionist perspective. There is a full spectrum of other perspectives on this issue. Come on the media. Where are the other ones?
But David Harris, executive director of the American Jewish Committee, writes, quote, "The notion that powerful Jewish groups are squelching debate is nonsense. Discussion on Israel has been vigorous and open in the Jewish community and beyond. Just look at the extensive media Jimmy Carter has gotten since his controversial book on Israel came out. If the American public supports Israel, as opinion polls repeatedly show, then maybe the explanation is as simple as because Americans admire a vibrant democracy in a rough-and-tumble region. Also, the much-discussed essay by Indiana University professor Alvin Rosenfeld, published by the American Jewish Committee, came up. Mistakenly, you accused it of targeting liberal American Jews. The essay wasn't at all about liberal Jews, many of whom are our members. Rather, it was about Jews who demonize Israel and challenge its right to exist. Just because they're Jews doesn't give them an exemption from scrutiny and, yes, criticism."
We're okay with criticism. Send it to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
A collective nation scratched its head in 2006 when the president said he was reading The Stranger, Camus' existentialist classic. And we were just as puzzled around Christmas when he told the Washington Post that he'd just finished King Leopold's Ghost, the tragic history of colonial Congo. The president didn't elaborate, but unlike Camus, the author could and did. Adam Hochschild said his nearly 10-year-old account of Belgium's King Leopold resonates today as a study of a ruler's foreign ambitions whose motives are unclear to his countrymen and kept unclear through secrecy, misdirection, and public relations. Hochschild said Leopold was a spinmeister of Karl Rovian caliber. Only Leopold was spinning the torture, starvation, and murder of millions in the pursuit of ivory and rubber. His media manipulations ranged from the crude bribery of editors to the clever exploitation of celebrity. In fact, he hired the era's best-known explorer, Henry Morton Stanley, the famous finder of Dr. Livingstone, to map his new colony. The king's task was to find a way to claim it.
Leopold was a master at public relations, and he realized that the only way he was going to get all the nations of Europe and the United States to recognize his hold over this territory was if he could convince them that he was doing something philanthropic. He wanted to bring civilization and Christianity to the poor, benighted natives and to stop the slave trade from Africa to the Arab world, which was indeed something that was going on. But Leopold turned much of the adult male population of the Congo into slave laborers of a sort himself.
And Leopold put a sturdy lock on any critical information coming from the country for nearly 10 years. What did that silence allow Leopold to accomplish?
Beginning in the early 1890s, Leopold established this forced labor system, and there was this tremendous loss of life. It was a Holocaust in that sense. And you know, most Americans, if they graduated from high school or college, they've actually most likely read a book which comes from that time and place. And I'm speaking of Joseph Conrad's novel, Heart of Darkness. Conrad spent 6 months in the Congo in 1890 as a steamboat officer. And he was there long enough to really get a sense of the atmosphere of a gold rush, where you could have all the fun of getting rich and at the same time of shooting down Africans.
And you write that he had any number of models for Kurtz.
That's right. The Belgian officer named Captain Leon Rom, whom the evidence seems to indicate that Conrad met briefly. And some years later, a British journalist visiting the Congo noticed that Captain Rom had 22 severed African heads as a border around his garden.
Now, there were other reporters in the Congo, but you write that at this point, no one reported honestly what they'd seen. In fact, the first man who broke the story wasn't even there. He was a shipping clerk in Belgium. And you liken him to a railway employee in, say, Nazi Germany who might have wondered what was happening to all those Jews.
His name was Edmund Dean Morel. And at the turn of the century, he found himself working as a shipping clerk for a British shipping company that had the monopoly on all the cargo traffic between the Congo and Belgium. The company used to send him over to the Belgian port of Antwerp every couple of weeks to check in their ships. He noticed that when these ships arrived from Africa, they were carrying these enormously valuable cargoes of rubber and of ivory, but that when they turned around and sailed back to the Congo, they carried nothing to Africa to pay for all this stuff coming to Europe. He realized that he was watching evidence of a slave labor system. Morel quit his job and turned himself in the space of a few years into the great British investigative reporter of his time.
His main outlet was a paper that he set up called the West African Mail. I wonder, what kind of influence could a specialty newspaper about West Africa have in England in the 1890s?
Well, he started off there, but he also very soon started something called the Congo Reform Association. The Congo Reform Association published a long string of pamphlets and photographs that had been taken by the missionaries of, you know, people with their hands cut off, people being whipped, hostages in chains. They used every possible kind of media of the day to get their message out, and they were really very effective in doing this. Morel wrote many, many articles for the mainstream British press and came over to the United States, went to the White House, saw Theodore Roosevelt, told him about it. He and Conan Doyle, you know, the man who wrote the Sherlock Holmes books, made a lecture tour together. Mark Twain and Booker T. Washington appeared together in the United States speaking on this subject at Morel's instigation.
How did he get the evidence he needed?
People inside the Congo bureaucracy, with guilty consciences, knew that he was the person to whom they should leak their documents, and they did. When, for instance, Morel exposed this hostage-taking system for forcing people to gather wild rubber, Leopold and his people, of course, denied it. Well, Morel was then able to reproduce the blank form in French that was sent to every district post head in the Congo, where you were supposed to list how many hostages you were holding and for what period of time.
So you've got these two characters, Leopold and Morel, squared off over a country that neither of them ever visited, and they're both masters of PR. But how did Leopold counter Morel's arsenal of irrefutable evidence?
He paid various people to go to the Congo and write books about how enlightened his administration was, got some of them to make lecture tours as well. He published a trilingual magazine called The Truth About the Congo that you found on your seat if you booked a sleeping compartment on a European train during this era, and that reached a very elite audience.
Now, ultimately, it was two huge PR disasters that turned the tide against Leopold. One was when his chief lobbyist in the United States got frustrated at being sidelined and went public. And the second was when his own, quote-unquote, official investigation of Congo atrocities blew up in his face. Let's take that second one. How did he let that happen?
There was this mounting tide of criticism. So Leopold said, well, I'm shocked at these accusations, and I'm going to send an investigative commission to the Congo. So he picked three judges, people who owed him favors or were hoping for jobs from him. But amazingly, these three judges actually did their job, and Leopold knew he was in trouble when he began getting reports back in Europe that when hearing from African witnesses, one of the judges had broken down and wept. His governor general in the Congo, after being interviewed by the three judges, had committed suicide, and these judges were going to release their report in French on a certain date.
And that's when he pioneered a stunningly clever ploy that's still used today.
He knew that his real trouble was going to be in England and the United States. So what he did was he prepared a so-called summary of the report in English and arranged to have a fake front organization that he'd set up release it the day before. And of course, newspaper reporters always like to have their work done for them, and they wrote their stories based on this summary. Then Leopold managed to do something else as well. He had only limited control over these judges because he'd set them up as an independent commission, but he managed to get the actual transcripts of the hearings that they held, the testimony of several hundred African witnesses, embargoed, locked up, inaccessible to anybody until 1984, more than 75 years later.
Nearly a decade has passed since your book was published, and you call this the first international atrocity scandal in the age of the telegraph and the camera. Is it as easy now to manipulate the media?
I think maybe it's a little bit harder. When Rumsfeld was forced to step down as Secretary of Defense, somebody asked him what was the worst thing that happened during his reign, and he said it was the day the Abu Ghraib photos were released. Didn't say it was the day I first found out this was happening or the day that these kinds of mistreatments of prisoners began. He said it was the day that the photos were released. I like to think that even though horrible atrocities still go on in this world of ours today, we do have means of getting the information out that didn't exist before.
Adam, thank you very much.
Pleasure being with you.
Adam Hochschild is the author of King Leopold's Ghost, a story of greed, terror, and heroism in colonial Africa.
Coming up, are presidential campaigns getting longer, or does it just seem that way? And why hiccups matter.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a dust-up between putative Democratic frontrunners Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Obama supporter David Geffen said some nasty things about the Clintons, and the Clinton campaign said Obama should give Geffen's money back. Oh, dear. Now pundits have the chance to jawbone over whether Obama can stick to his promise to run a positive campaign. Insiders, of course, are especially interested in the man behind Obama's campaign, media consultant David Axelrod. He ran Obama's Senate race and Deval Patrick's successful bid to be the first black governor of Massachusetts. Can he craft a winning campaign for the first black president? Christopher Hayes profiled Axelrod in last week's issue of The Nation. He says Axelrod was coaxed out of journalism and into politics by Harold Washington's campaign to be Chicago's first black mayor.
What happened in 1983, this is the first time he ran, he won the Democratic primary, much to white Chicago's chagrin. Chicago is a notoriously Democratic town, and whoever wins the Democratic primary essentially gets to be mayor. But a somewhat obscure Republican named Bernie Epton was catapulted as the kind of great white hope to defeat Harold Washington. And his slogan in that campaign was, quote, "Before it's too late."
Right. But it wasn't until Washington's re-election campaign in 1987 that Axelrod really became a player in politics and not just writing about it.
That's right. He'd left his, he had this kind of meteoric rise of the Tribune. He'd left that job to work on Paul Simon's 1984 Senate campaign. After that, he started a consulting firm and he started working for local candidates, black candidates particularly, and he worked for Harold Washington in 87. And Washington actually did better among white voters in 1987 than he had in 1983, but still he won a tiny percentage of the white vote, this despite having campaigned predominantly in white neighborhoods and made a very, very hard kind of sell to bring white voters over. And Axelrod was there for all of it. He was doing Harold Washington's media during that campaign.
So why was this campaign so pivotal for Axelrod?
Well, the reason it was pivotal, I think, is because he saw racial politics at its most brutal, particularly the kind of minefield that a black candidate has to walk. There was all these rumors that, Harold Washington was going to essentially give City Hall over to Chicago's black community and whites would suddenly find themselves outside the power structure. And I think Axelrod saw that and learned a lot of lessons about how to go about or how to attempt to go about packaging black candidates who are running for office such that white voters can sort of feel comfortable in voting for them, even with all the sort of latent racism that might be there.
Talk about how Axelrod first hooked up with Barack Obama.
You know, Axelrod told me that he had heard about Obama when Obama was in the state Senate. I think they had been friendly and actually had formed a relationship even before Obama decided definitively to run for the Senate seat in 2003. There was a very crowded primary field, and everybody wanted Axelrod. I mean, he essentially is the by far the big name political consultant here in Chicago. He knows Chicago politics better than anyone, and he decided to go with Obama. There's one candidate who is a self-funded millionaire with a lot more money. There was another candidate who was sort of the son of a machine politician. Obama was not seen as likely to win the race, but Axelrod had a lot of faith in him and in his appeal. And the two of them got very lucky because they had the front-runner Blair Hull, the aforementioned self-funded millionaire, sort of self-destruct over his divorce records just at the time that Obama was going up on the air with these very sort of inspiring, hopeful ads that Axelrod had crafted. And they waltzed to a pretty resounding victory in the primary. I think Axelrod's two ads he cut for Obama had a lot to do with that.
Describe those ads. What made them so inspirational?
The first was an ad with the theme, Yes, We Can. And it was a sort of ingenious way of weaving together the very sort of astounding biography of Obama and his record and this kind of hopeful message in which he sort of said, you know, they said there couldn't be a black president of the Harvard Law Review, but I did it. And they said we couldn't give health care to children. We did it.
Or give tax relief to the working poor or pass new laws to stop wrongful executions. But I have. Now they say we can't change Washington. I'm Barack Obama. I'm running for the United States Senate, and I approve this message to say, yes, we can.
The other ad was wildly successful. It was an endorsement from Paul Simon, who is a very popular senator in Illinois. Simon had agreed to endorse Obama and then had died, actually, before he could ever record the ad. And what Axelrod came up with was he talked to Simon's daughter.
I know Barack Obama will be a U.S. senator in the Paul Simon tradition. You see, Paul Simon was my dad.
Paul Simon was from predominantly a very white area of downstate Illinois, areas outside of, say, Southside Chicago, where Obama had a kind of built-in African-American base. And this was a way of sort of expanding his appeal across racial lines.
Okay, so it seems as if Axelrod is a kind of kindler, gentler message manager. At some point, he's going to have to go negative.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, I should say that he can throw punches, I think, with the best of them when the occasion calls for. And I've seen ads that he's done, attack ads that were pretty brutal. Not attack ads of the sort of, you know, so-and-so was having an affair, but I mean sort of issue-based attack ads. There's also going to be the added layer of the very strong and sometimes unseemly racial politics that are going to come into play. And there's going to be pressure from all sides. We're already seeing stories about black authenticity. If he steps towards that, there'll be white commentators saying he's quote-unquote too black. In campaigns, your opponents often get a say in whether you're a polarizing figure or not. And the question is, to the degree that the Obama campaign with Axelrod's counsel can dictate the terms of their own kind of unifying message.
How do you think Axelrod will handle that?
Having reported the story and gone back and delved through the racial history of Chicago politics that Axelrod came out of, you realize that if there's anyone who's well sort of trained to handle it, it is Axelrod. And I think that the unity message that they've crafted, it has a dimension to it, I believe, that is an acknowledgement of the fact that divisiveness is something that's been thrown at black politicians and black civil rights leaders from all the way back. So I think that in some senses, the entire rhetoric of the campaign, its entire rhetorical approach is a kind of preemptive way of dealing with a lot of the kind of tacit implied issues about Obama's race.
But it would seem, Chris, that everything you're talking about speaks to Axelrod's experience in assuaging the fears of white voters. What's he going to do if the bigger challenge for Obama is to convince black voters to vote for him?
Well, that's a really good question. And that, I think, is the interesting turn that we've seen in the media narrative, at least in the last week, particularly with the early importance of South Carolina and Obama's visit down there. Obama's one defeat as a candidate, and this is before his association with Axelrod, was his 2000 race to unseat Bobby Rush in a almost entirely black district on the south side of Chicago, in which the charge that was leveled at him exactly was that he was this sort of interloper and outsider, and in which he was sort of unable to convince a largely African-American community to vote for him. It's going to be a real issue. And in terms of what Axelrod has planned for Obama in terms of avoiding that part of the minefield, I couldn't say.
Chris, thank you so much.
Brooke, thanks so much for having me.
Christopher Hayes is a Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. So how does Axelrod plan to deal with the possibility that black voters may not embrace his candidate? We asked him.
You know, when we started the race for Illinois, he was in the polls getting about a third of the African-American vote, maybe slightly less than that. He ended up getting 92 to 95% of it. I think that there is a process, and it's the right process. People need to get to know him. He's not asking for people to vote for him on the basis of the fact that he's African-American. He has to go out and earn those votes. And so I think these issues will go away.
In Obama's Senate race, he used the slogan, "Yes, we can." So did Deval Patrick in the Massachusetts race for governor. Are you concerned that some of the hallmarks of an Axelrod campaign, some of those tropes may become a little too familiar?
Well, you know, I think that may be for a few insiders, but let me just be really, really clear about this. I do not bring these things to these campaigns so much as I look for candidates who reflect the kinds of values in politics that I care about. And that tagline reflects that, and I'm sure you'll hear it some more.
You probably have already seen the beginning of a negative campaign against Obama. What do you anticipate will happen that "Yes, we can" isn't going to answer?
Let me say that there's no doubt that politics is a tough pursuit. Harold Washington used to tell us that politics ain't beanbag. That doesn't mean that the whole thing has to devolve into a kind of reality show contest of insults, and that's not what we're going to do.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Media consultant David Axelrod. And now, something for all of you who don't really care about the Clinton-Obama dust-up, or why one of John Edwards' bloggers quit, or whether Mitt Romney or Sam Brownback was against abortion first. In other words, all of you who think that 22 months of presidential campaigning is just too much. I mean, this has got to be the earliest ever campaign, right? Well, not according to historian Michael Kazin. In a recent Washington Post op-ed, he wrote that the permanent campaign has been with us since at least 1826, when Martin Van Buren began building the first modern party, soon named the Democrats. He did it in part to avenge Andrew Jackson's unjust defeat in the previous election.
He went around really right after the 1824 election, beginning to talk to state politicos in various parts of the country, beginning to start newspapers, which would be pro-Jackson newspapers. The Whig Party, which began during the Jackson administration, did the same thing. And by the 1830s, it was not unusual to have three or four candidates in each major party vying for the nomination a couple of years ahead of time.
So who holds the title for the longest campaign ever?
Well, I like to think it was William Jennings Bryan, who I've written a biography about recently. Bryan was defeated in the campaign of 1896, his epic campaign by William McKinley. And as soon as the campaign was over, he and his wife compiled his speeches, put together some memories of the campaign trail, and put out a book called The First Battle, which made it very clear that the next battle had just begun. And that was just 1 month after the election of 1896. So for the next 4 years, Bryan was doing little else but running for the presidency.
Okay, so it's one thing for candidates to wage all-out personal marketing campaigns years before the election. But it's another thing, Michael, for reporters to actually take the bait.
The press was, if anything, in the late 19th century, more competitive than now. Every local paper wanted to have a campaign story as soon after the last campaign as possible. They wanted to handicap who the frontrunners would be for the next campaign. And so it was pretty much nonstop. Speeches that candidates gave were printed verbatim in the press, which doesn't happen now, really. Of course, we can see them online, so we don't have to read them. But the best job in American journalism in the late 19th century was to be a political reporter, not just in Washington or New York, but everywhere in the country. And the way you showed your mettle as a political reporter was by writing these long features about candidates when they came to your town. Because after all, political reporters needed the candidates and vice versa, just as now. So these complaints about, oh my God, the campaigns are starting so early, kind of crocodile tears, because journalists would not be in business if they didn't.
What about the scale of the machines that these candidates have put together? It seems that at least those are larger than they've ever been. These are multi-million dollar operations with huge war rooms and loads of staff advisors, that sort of thing.
Yes, I think that's certainly true, especially for presidential candidates and gubernatorial candidates for the most part, too. And that didn't happen in Bryan's day, or for that matter, in Van Buren's day. Then the party really was the organization. And now the individual candidate's organization is the organization, and the individual candidate is responsible for raising most of the money.
100 years ago, when campaigns were cheaper, was there as much incentive to start stumping early?
Well, not quite as much, because people could depend on the party dunning its members, its office holders as well, for the campaign. But even then, money made a big difference. For example, in 1896, when Bryan ran for the first time against McKinley, the Democratic Party was only able to raise $250,000 for that whole campaign, whereas the Republicans raised about $4 million, which in today's money, it's equal to about $100 million, which is pretty much equal to the amount of money that each nominee for each major party is going to raise this year.
Wow. So if you adjust for inflation, it's just as flooded with money as ever.
Yes. The only difference is that the candidate himself or herself doesn't have to spend so much of their time raising it.
So when you hear commentators, editorial writers, callers into talk shows say, oh, my God, I can't believe this campaign is starting so early. I can't believe we're in the age of the permanent campaign. Do you just roll your eyes and say, ah, it is as it ever was, quit your belly aching?
I think that the people who say that are not so crazy about politics often. People who love politics, as I do, I must admit, have no problem with a permanent campaign, or have a few problems with a permanent campaign. We wish they were more substantive to it, of course. We wish it were more dramatic, probably. But so many Americans who complain about campaigns are complaining about what they see as a sort of phoniness, inauthenticity in what the candidates are saying and how they're presenting themselves. But when there's a candidate who seems to be very exciting, like Ronald Reagan in 1980, like Howard Dean for a short time at least in 2004, perhaps like Barack Obama today, that you don't hear that many people complain about the length of the campaign in relation to those specific candidates who have a real passionate following.
Michael, thank you very much.
Glad to do it.
Michael Kazin's recent book is A Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan. Here's a clip of that permanent campaigner 100 years ago.
There is no sound reason for secrecy in regard to campaign methods, and publicity will in itself prove a purifying influence in politics.
Heard about Jennifer Mee, the Florida 15-year-old who's had the hiccups for a month solid? Here she was this week on Morning TV.
Good morning,
morning
to you
everybody.
All. I feel so bad
Good
for
morning.
You, Jennifer. I know this started January 23rd, first period science class, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
First, it's kind of funny. It's not funny, is
not
it?
Not anymore. It's not.
No.
Not at all.
That was Meredith Vieira of NBC's Today Show. Good Morning America desperately wanted Hiccup Girl, too, but failed to snag her, albeit not for want of trying. According to Jennifer's father, GMA Bookers called 57 times trying to coax the kid onto ABC. The episode has brought the latest stain of disrepute on the soft news industry. This right after the death of basket case pinup girl Anna Nicole Smith consumed 50% of all cable news airtime over 2 days. Plus, Brittany Sheard and other earth-shaking developments that trumped, for instance, President Bush's saber-rattling towards Iran. Doesn't this prove that the media have surrendered and the society is doomed? No, it doesn't mean that. Oh, sure, GMA needs to learn the difference between persistence and harassment, and yeah, there are more important things than hiccuping teenagers. But hold on just one second. Aren't you curious about what it's like to deal with this?
You've been to a pediatrician, a cardiologist, a neurologist, blood test, a CT scan, an MRI.
I am. In fact, 15 years or so ago, for all things considered, I interviewed a fellow named John Crosland, who'd had the hiccups for 3 decades. The story served no journalistic purpose beyond what they used to call human interest. But see, the thing about human interest is that humans are interested in it. Sound editorial judgment doesn't mean never slaking the public's thirst for the trivial. Sometimes producers and editors are compared to doctors who are supposed to prescribe what's healthy, not what the patient necessarily wants. Good analogy, up to a point, but Editors are also like bartenders who must serve up what's ordered, provided they know when to say, "Sorry, bub, you've had enough." As for the idea we've somehow in 2007 reached news fluff rock bottom, well, here's another Today Show clip.
That's a great little toy, though, for a toy. I wouldn't exactly even call it a toy. It's a... You brought me a bell?
That was Today host Dave Garraway talking to his sidekick, J. Fred Muggs. This was in 1953. Muggs was a chimpanzee. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Peter Garner and Chris Wirth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.